Hello, this is Osman with House Einstein, and this is podcast number 7, House Einstein's podcast number 7, The Truth About Pocket Listings. And with me is Hamish Crabb.
Welcome, everyone.
Before we get started this time, I just want to mention a few things for those that are new to the podcast. Again, my name is Osman Parvez. I'm the founder of House Einstein. We are a real estate brokerage primarily located in Boulder, Colorado, although we also work in the Denver market and all locations in between. We've done deals as far north as Fort Collins and as far south as Castle Rock. And we've just started launching into the mountains as well. And we have a new listing at the moment in Breckenridge. And we have agents on the team that cover these markets. If you're looking to find us, if you like what you hear on the podcast and would like to find us, you can do so at houseeinstein.com. And with that said, why don't we get into it?
Let's.
Okay. So I guess I should mention one thing also, a little bit of a disclaimer, that the best way to think about this podcast is as entertainment, especially if you're not our client. That is coming from the legal people that advise us that this is not real estate advice for you, and it's certainly not legal advice. You should consult your own real estate advisor, your own legal advisor, your own spiritual and religious advisor before you jump into real estate investments, and whether that's buying or selling for your personal use or buying or selling as an investment, there are certainly lots of risks. And results can vary dramatically. Okay, that's the disclaimer. That's a little CYA language. And now I think we could finally really get into it.
Yeah. No doubt you've seen the title already, so you have a general idea of what that is. Osman, you think you've got the definition.
Right. Okay, so yeah. What are pocket listings? And that's a euphemism. There are lots of ways listings are disseminated to the real estate community as well as to individual buyers before they actually hit the market. And it can be incredibly problematic. So pocket listings are when we know of a listing coming to market and we share it with our sphere, our clients, other realtors. And before there were rules, and we'll get to the rules too, these pocket listings were frequently being marketed by realtors as an exclusive opportunity to sell your home, potentially get more money, and not even put it on the MLS. Or if I'm representing the buy side, I'm a realtor that was marketing their prowess in pocket listings might say, hey, I've been selling homes in Boulder for 30 years, and I know everybody, and I know of homes before they hit the market. In fact, my brokerage has a special private network where we talk about the listings within the brokerage, and often the homes are sold before they even hit the market to our clients. So use me as your realtor because of my special magic network.
Exclusivity.
Exclusivity. I will get you the listing before anybody else. And that's what's called a pocket listing. In reality, it doesn't really work like that. So first, let's talk about some of the pros, and then we're going to talk about some of the cons, and then we're going to talk about how the real estate community has responded to pocket listings. So if you're a seller and you've started the process, like actually we're going up to Sugarloaf later this afternoon to go look at an amazing new listing. It is, we're under a listing agreement. We're just getting started. We're probably 2 weeks away from activating the listing. It is an unreal house, right? It's spectacular. I can't give you the address because if I were to do so, it would engage a whole process that we now have to follow because we've announced that this listing is coming on market. But I could shop this listing to my buyers and I could say, hey, buyers, I've got this amazing new listing. You should go look at it. Of course, I also have a representation obligation to the seller, right? So for the seller's perspective, here's the pitch. I've got a buyer that is going to pay more than market is going to close quickly. They're reasonable people. You're not going to have issues on inspection. We don't have to put it on the MLS until you're actually under contract. It doesn't create a negative listing history. And in some cases, some brokerage won't even put it under on the MLS even until it closes. So if you're a member of the MLS, and this is one of those regulation things, you are required to put your sales on the MLS so that there is a track record and these comparables are available to other realtors so they can better advise their clients on the market. So members of the MLS, which are virtually every real estate agent, put their listings on the MLS to create more market data to better advise buyers and sellers collectively. Everyone benefits from better and more accurate data, and that's why we're required to put it on the MLS. And so it sounds kind of appealing from a seller perspective, because you're going to get maybe even more than you think it's worth, and you should not have a negative track record on the MLS, and the deal could go smoother because you're doing a deal with your realtor or real estate agent, the person you trust, your friend, the real estate agent. Well, it turns out there's a lot of cons to that situation too, a lot of negatives. And one of those is that you actually have no idea if you're getting market value, right? And how do you know that this is truly a fair price if the whole market has not seen the listing? You could be leaving significant amounts of money on the table. And unless you're really confident that you're getting a premium for your property to market value, you should be hesitant to take a pocket listing deal as a seller. Now, as a buyer, there's other cons too. And actually, this con applies to the seller too. How do you know that the agent is representing your best interests? And this is where the listing agreement, at least here in Colorado, defines it. Some states have something called dual agency. We don't have that here in Colorado. You cannot be a dual agent. You either represent the buyer or you represent the seller, or you are neutral between the two. And the neutral between the two requires systems to do properly. And when we're doing that, it's called transaction brokerage. We have to adhere to those systems. There is a fourth option where the person buying the house or selling the house is just a customer. That's even more problematic. And usually when the buyer is a customer and you represent the seller as an agent exclusively, the buyer feels really uncomfortable. And so how does this agent, right? How does this person who represents, I mean, how does the pitch sound to you, Hamish? I represent the seller exclusively and their best interests, and you're a customer, and just trust me to do the deal. We're going to make sure you know, it's going to work out for you just fine. Here's my working definitions disclosure document we're required to provide. I mean, you're spending here in Boulder, you're spending often millions of dollars on this piece of property. But even if you're just spending hundreds of thousands of dollars, it's real money that you are investing into this piece of property. So all sorts of red flags start to appear. Like, how does this work?
It's a difficult balance when you have a literal fiduciary responsibility to one party, and then the other party you can't represent in the same manner. So.
In the listing agreement, it suddenly disappears, your fiduciary responsibility, and now you're neutral. Like, even the transaction, I'm never comfortable in the transaction brokerage process. I tell my sellers that if we have to go to transaction brokerage, I have to give the buyer everything I've given you, all of the comps. Now, what's really interesting is that, you know, there's an advocacy role for agents in the deal, not just when it comes to the purchase price, but to getting inspection issues resolved. And we know what the norms are. People that have been doing this for a long time should have a firm grasp on what's typical in a deal. So, for example, an HVAC system, if it's discovered on inspection to be failing, it's not necessarily common that the seller pays for a brand new HVAC system, because when you wrote the offer, it wasn't a brand new HVAC system. You knew it was older. So what is fair? And usually half life or half the cost is where we land or try to land if we're neutral. But if I'm advocating for the seller and you're a customer, I'm trying to hammer you for every dollar you got. That's my job. And I'm going to try to extract maximum value and for the seller so they get the most amount of money in the deal. And I'm going to say, you know, I'm sorry, the HVAC's old. look, we're going to go to market, and there's three other buyers interested in this house. If you want to make a big deal over this $15,000 HVAC system, the seller is ready to just put it on market. And I'm sorry to share that with you, but that's where we are. And even if that's not true, I'm trying to do that type of positioning because, again, I represent the interests of the seller exclusively. So knowing the stance, if you will, the structure of how the agent relates to the buyer and seller is crucial when you are going into one of these pocket deals and you don't have your own representation. So there's some serious cons to this structure, buyer or seller. Seller doesn't know if they're actually getting market value. Buyer may not be getting adequate representation. And even if they're legally in the transaction brokerage position, the buyer knows that the listing agent has a pre-existing relationship with the seller. So it'd be like, you and I are golfing buddies, Hamish, and I'm listing your house, and our kids go to school together. We've been buddies for 20 years, and now I'm supposed to be neutral and represent a buyer. Like, it doesn't make sense, right? Like, how are you going to be neutral when you have a pre-existing? So I'm always extremely uncomfortable when I'm in the transaction brokerage position, even though I make more money on the commission. So the agent also often what's called double ends. Some agents will discount the commission so that they don't get the complete buy and sell side of the deal, which in Colorado is often 5.6% to 6%, at least here in the Boulder market. It's more than that in the Breck market. It's less than that in the Denver market. But collecting both sides of the deal adds yet another conflicting problem, right? Because now the agent's really incentivized to make the deal happen. And they may discount it, right? So instead of collecting 5.6, maybe they collect 4%, or maybe they collect 3.5%. But they're clearly collecting more, and they're doing more work, so that makes sense. But how do you navigate all these variables?
And at the end of the day, they're only doing work for the seller, in essence, right? Because if you have buyers as a customer, you're just filing paperwork at that point. You know, you can't really advise them on negotiation or any of those techniques or strategies. They're just there for you.
You're also supposed to disclose all known material defects, which if you've been doing this business for 20 plus years, as I have, you walk into a house and you can start to see the defects, right? You're like, okay, so now I'm going to get paid more, but I'm supposed to disclose all the problems to this buyer. And it the number of problems that crop up, the increased liability for the seller that is created in the context of the deal, is it really worth it? And so you started to hear a lot of negatives. And this is, we're going to skip ahead in our little outline, Hamish. This is one of the most important things to think about when you are approached with a pocket deal. Is the agent that's presenting this to me, does this person also present some of the downsides of the deal? And Hamish, by the way, when you hit that mute, I hear the white noise disappear. It changes pretty dramatically. You should just probably let it go unless there's a plane passing by or something. Because the ambient sound changes dramatically in the background of the recording. So if the bottom line is, if your agent is not walking you through all of the pros and cons, or at least quite a few of them, and helping you think about them, there's a really good chance they are so conflicted that they have adopted a sales role for themselves to make more money. That would be my conclusion, because there's so many pros and cons for both buyer and seller in a deal where there's only one agent, that the only way for the clients, the buyer and seller, to make an intelligent decision is by walking you through all these pros and cons. So it doesn't mean that it can't work, but here's how we usually present it, and often why we don't do double-ended deals. We tell our clients that if you want to buy a house before it's hitting the market, one, you should be paying a premium to what we think the house is worth, because you are getting early access to this listing. So you should expect to pay a little bit more. And you should also know that the market has not opined about this house. You could be dramatically overpaying. So there's a risk of you dramatically overpaying for this house. There's also conflicts in the representation, and I would walk them through that. And I tell them, look, I'm a person that takes their ethics and their integrity seriously, but at the same time, these conflicts exist. And it's very challenging to structure it in a way that you don't have these conflicts in place. On the sell side, I'm going to say basically the same thing, that, look, I now have to become neutral because we're going to transaction brokerage, because the whole customer relationship isn't going to work. They're going to want neutrality. And that means I'm not going to advocate for you in terms of negotiation over inspection items. I am going to tell the buyer that they probably should pay a premium. And I'm going to say the same thing to you, that if you are accepting a pre-market deal, this buyer is getting privileged position. We think your house is worth, let's say, 1.5. We really should be aiming for 1.55 or 1.6 because it's a pre-market deal. No one likes, the buyer hates the sound of this, by the way. You want me to pay $100,000? I thought you were my friend. I thought you wanted to pay $100,000 more for the house. And that's really where the deal should land. So when you see these pocket deals, I often just will conclude this person overpaid for the house, or the seller left a lot of money on the table. And I've seen that side too, where there's double representation, or it's the same agent on both sides of the deal on the MLS. And I look at how this house compares to the comps, and I'm like, this house is under market $100,000. And I don't know what happened here, but maybe the buyer and the agent had a pre-existing relationship. Like, there's something a little bit off about this deal. Why did it go for so cheap? And then the worst thing is when there's no photos inside, right? It's just, here's the price. So now you can't even evaluate it properly in the comp set.
So they really just put it on paper that the sale happened, but you don't get to know anything else about the deal. You know,
that's right.
Could be a buddy deal, or
here's the bedrooms and baths. Here's the square footage. Here's one photo, if you even get that of the house. And they don't even go much of a description in the broker remarks or the listing description in words. So you're kind of guessing at what this house is, but then you compare it to the comp set. It's harder for unique homes, custom homes in Boulder, but let's say we're looking at more standard homes in Indian Peaks or Longmont, homes that are, or Superior, homes that were built by one builder that put together, you know, 50 or 100 models of the same house, and suddenly you have one outlier that's really skewed one way or the other. And it's sometimes it's skewed too low, and that's very troubling when I look at that as a comp. So what actually happened, I don't know. But the commissions are actually disclosed, at least to the buy side, but not to the listing agent on the MLS. So we know how much the buyer's agent a buyer's agent would have been paid, and probably what the listing agent collected if they did both sides of the deal. But we don't know for sure because that's not public record.
Right.
If we were to bribe our friends at the title company, they might tell us, but it doesn't mean they will. I don't know if they're ethically allowed to. I don't know what the rules are for that, but if we really wanted to know, we could try to see if they would tell us who actually got paid and how much. But because of this sense of inequity between buyer and seller, you're also dramatically increasing the liability for the seller for failure to disclose material defects, for a buyer that grossly overpaid, or if the buyer grossly underpaid. Now the listing agent's dramatically exposed to a lawsuit for not actually being a transaction broker, but being a buddy with the buyer. So All of these reasons make pocket listings problematic for agents. And yet, we have brokerages that continue to market that they've got these networks going on. So this has been happening now ever since the market turned and listings started to decline. Options, you know, inventory started to decline. We started seeing this type of marketing occurring. And it's now triple regulated. So this is what those brokerages that claim to have these amazing private networks don't really want you to know. And that is, it is regulated at the state level. It is regulated at the MLS. And it is regulated at the National Association level. At least here in Colorado. So if you are an agent in Mississippi, I don't know the rules for how the state is regulating in Mississippi, but the rules for the National Association still apply. So here in Colorado, if you are a real estate agent, you are regulated by DORA, and DORA has a clear cooperation policy. And it says, and this is under, it's also for coming soon listings, it says, within one business day of marketing a property to the public, the listing broker must submit the listing to the MLS for cooperation with other MLS participants. Public marketing includes, but is not limited to, flyers displayed in windows, yard signs, digital marketing on public-facing websites, brokerage website displays, including IDX and VOW, digital communications marketing, i.e. email blasts, multiple brokerage listing sharing networks, and applications available to the general public. And virtually the exact same language you'll see in the National Association, or the NAR, and you'll also see the almost the exact same language on the regional MLSs. And for sure, Summit has it, Denver has it, under ReColorado, and the Boulder and North markets have it under IRES. Almost exactly the same verbiage. So three different levels of how this is regulated. And we take it seriously in the real estate community. If you are engaging in private marketing to other brokers selectively, so the idea that you can, you know, pitch this to your friends and not to the general public is problematic. Now, that doesn't mean that buyer's agents can't try, and I certainly will try, because some agents will tell us that they've got listings coming. But if we go to under contract, there's all sorts of problems that are created in that process. But usually that falls to the listing agent, not the buyer's agent who found the deal. So, for example, I had a listing in in Arapahoe Ridge last year. And while we were prepping, actually this is 2 years ago, the seller had contacted one other agent in the neighborhood who does a lot of listings in that neighborhood, and said, come take a look at my house. And they considered both of us, and they chose us in the end. And we listed it. And right before we went live on the MLS, that agent called me and said, hey, Osman, I've got a buyer for that house. We'd like to see it. Well, we weren't in coming soon status. It hadn't been marketed to the general public. He happened to know about it because he had been considered for the listing. Mm-hmm. And in the end, his client actually ended up buying the house. But that fell between the gaps. It wasn't public marketing. It wasn't private marketing to my clients. It wasn't on some special broker sharing network. Now, you can actually share the listing within your office. But with some of these large brokerages, what defines the office, right? There's some brokerages with 300 agents. It's still not the whole MLS, but is that a private office? So this is an area for DORA and the regulators to figure out what to do about. But because it's now triple regulated, it's not that common. The marketing is disingenuous. So any agent that's telling you that they've got this special network and we can sell it for more and it won't be on the MLS, or I've got access to listings that no one ever sees, it's smoke and mirrors. It's actually not true. And if you look at the percentage of deals that, even the ones that go under contract early, very quickly, it's usually different offices on the buy and sell side. It's rare that it's actually the Whisper network.
Yeah. It seems to be mostly marketing jargon. And especially, I mean, we've touched on this throughout the podcast, but you are leaving so much on the table by not utilizing the MLS, because that disseminates to public listing services as well, you know, like your Redfin or your realtor.com, where general people can see the listings, and that can build even more competition. It right. Just feels like you're leaving more on the table by trying to participate in this exclusive network.
It's not that these things don't happen, right? The real estate community is closely knit. And when we are at the closing table or throughout the context of a deal, I'll ask the other side, hey, what you got going on? There's an agent in town who called this insider trading. This insider trading happens, but it is not the most common approach. It's extremely unlikely. And in order to maximize the potential of it, to help our clients who are looking for a house to buy, we maintain great relationships with the sell side. Across Colorado, especially here in Boulder and in Denver, we behave ethically. We have good communication throughout the deal. We maintain good client control, and I mean that by we set expectations early. We don't put property under contract flippantly. We help them stay in what's called good faith, which is the position in the contract that's required of buyers and sellers. When they want to do something unethical, we remind them of their good faith provision. Are you sure you want to do that? Are you sure you want to write an offer on another property at the same time you're under contract? Because you're not going to be able to buy both. And it's not a legit thing to do. And if you get caught, you could lose your earnest money.
Have you had that?
Oh, yeah.
Really? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's been years because we have this conversation early. When I'm on the buy side, I really want to make sure my buyers have thought through their options. before they write the offer, because if they've only seen three houses and we're writing an offer on day one, in my opinion, that's a nightmare, because they will then doubt themselves throughout the entire transaction process. There's a high probability of that. And so, if I would like to at least sit down with them and do a digital review of what sold in the last 3 or 4 months to make sure this is really what they want, because otherwise they could be in jeopardy of acting in bad faith. There's a really good chance we're going to terminate anyway. We're creating bad relationships in the real estate community. So I'd rather than that, or they buy the wrong house. All of these are bad options. If you're representing a buyer that's only seen a few houses, the outcomes are horrible. So the best outcome is, yeah, they've seen a bunch of other houses and they agree this is the right one. But at a minimum, we can go through the process and look at the MLS and see what else would have fit. I did that recently with a client in Newlands, and there were like one house every month or two that would have matched their basic criteria. Well, with that knowledge, you're really gambling, right? Like that a better house is going to show up. So
yeah. Depends on the pickiness of the buyer too. Right.
Right. And buying real estate is emotional. And you would think it's not. We're talking about large dollar numbers, but it is. People sometimes make emotional decisions that they later come to regret. Most of the time, people get confirmation bias rather than the other way around. But every once in a while, they start to doubt themselves. And if you haven't done your work with the buyer beforehand, the odds of that is much, much higher. Okay, so let's say you are, unfortunately, the victim of overpaying for a listing, and your agent said they're a transaction broker but clearly failed to disclose adverse material defects in the property, showed you comps that were cherry-picked, even though they're supposed to be neutral. They basically extracted an extra $100,000 out of you, and you discovered it 2 or 3 months later that the listing agent is actually, you know, the goddaughter of the seller, or there's like some family relationship that wasn't disclosed, and they pretended to be a transaction broker, and you're pretty convinced that you overpaid for the house. Now what? In Colorado, if you are anywhere in the country, if you're a member of the National Association of Realtors, you are a realtor, and you are subject to the Code of Ethics. And the Code of Ethics, when I first heard the Code of Ethics, I thought, okay, it's just a Code of Ethics, but most agents aren't paying attention to it. And it turned out to actually not be true at all, that we have required education on ethics. And if you are a member of the National Association, as most highly successful agents are, you can make a complaint directly to the association, and they investigate every single one of them, and the penalties are actually pretty severe. So there are multiple ways to complain. The most important ones here in Colorado are a complaint to DORA, the Division of Regulatory Agencies, which oversees licensees. And if they are a realtor, which likely they are, you can also complain to the National Association. And of course, you should get legal counsel if you feel like you have been defrauded by the agent that was in the deal, for sure, that too. But those are basically your three avenues for recourse. But that's all after bad things happened. There's so much you can do to avoid bad things happening.
By then it's too late. Well, not too late, but by then you're reacting.
Right. Well, by then you're just trying to fix what happened that was bad. But there's so many things you can do before bad things happen. And the first and most important thing is choose your agent really carefully. And if you have an agent that's selling you on their private networks, I would be very cautious about that, especially if they're not sharing the downside risk of private networks and private deals. And if you've already hired this agent and they're now bringing you a pocket buyer, it could be a wonderful thing. And it's really that agent's risk to manage the whole transaction brokerage advocacy piece. But you better be really convinced that you're getting a good deal. And if you're not convinced you're getting a really good deal, you should be hesitant to take that off-market offer.
So if you have a two-agent, one representing the sell side, one representing the buy side on this pocket deal, I'm assuming it's a little bit more likely to turn out fairly amicable, though you should still expect a premium because it's a pocket listing.
That's a great question. So your question is, what if it's a pocket deal, but the buyer has their own agent?
Yeah.
The liability of a legal issue after closing now should drop dramatically, because I love it if the buyer is represented individually, because even though I make less money, the liability comes down so dramatically. This agent is supposed to be helping their client navigate the market, write intelligent contracts, do their due diligence, get a good deal, or at least get a property that suits their needs really well, help them go through inspections and discover any defects. All of that falls to their buyer's agent rather than supposedly somebody who's neutral in the deal. So it is possible, right? Like with the Arapaho Ridge listing, and that buyer's agent showed up. He had been working with his client for a while, and they knew the market, and the deal went really smoothly. And he's very competent, so there was no issues throughout the deal process. So if you are like, but those circumstances are unlikely. Right? Like where an agent has discovered a new listing that's already represented by a listing agent. It does happen. And I just gave you a real life example of it happening. And our sellers knew that there's a risk that they're not getting full market value, but that offer showed up day one. It didn't show up. Like the house actually hit the MLS, but did the whole MLS have an opportunity to see it? So sometimes people play what's called hurry up offense. This is a game where I call it hurry up offense, but basically there's a new listing and we get in early, and even though we're not supposed to, we somehow manage to get in early. Or we're like one of the first showings on a set. Showings begin Saturday morning, 9 AM. We are there at 8:50.
Yeah.
Walking around the outside of the house and getting ready to go inside as soon as we're allowed. We've done our evaluation ahead of time. We've run the comps ahead of time. We know this is the right house. We walk through the house and we are writing the offer in the car at 9:15.
Pre-drafted it.
And we're going to go strong, right? We're going to limit inspection contingencies. We're going to offer more than list. When we want an answer by the afternoon. Well, you create a real conundrum for the seller, because the whole market has not seen it. And now they've got this risk. If they say no to you, well, you might inevitably, that is a turnoff, right? It's like if somebody says, I'd like to take you out on a date, and you're like, well, I'll let you know in 3 days after I've seen who else wants to go out on a date. How does that feel?
Let me compare my options.
Right. It feels bad. And if you circle back to this person on Monday and say, okay, well, we set an offer submission deadline on Monday, but yours was the top offer. Can you resubmit? That also is problematic because there's a strong signal that now they're overpaying.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, so this is last year at kind of the top of the craze. You know, when we had our listings, we were doing Monday offer deadlines. And that, to me, seems like the most sensible strategy here, is because you can give a weekend for people to see the market, and then the agents will call you asking for offer guidelines, and you can do somewhat negotiation or tell them it's not even worth it for their buyers to pitch in. It's such a stark difference to what these pocket listings are trying to be when, you know, it's so strange.
There's definitely a contract. We're talking about two different things. Bidding wars over in the insanity of the spring of 2022. On the listing side, the best practice that we adopted was to early communicate that offers are not going to be looked at till Monday. Our client's out of town. They have blindfolds on. They're not going to look at an offer. They've instructed us not to present offers. So if you present an offer with a short fuse, if you play hurry up offense, we're just going to send it right back to you and say, look, we can't look at this till Monday. We want the whole market to look at it. And then we will look at all offers at Monday afternoon. And usually that's perceived as fair if you communicated that early, or you have a way of communicating that that's not offensive to the first buyer who shows up. Legally, you're required to present all offers. So even if the agent has said offers are due Monday, you can still submit a hurry-up offense. And the seller is not obliged to wait till Monday. So if you know those two things, which experienced agents do, you can still play hurry-up offense. And I've played hurry-up offense many times. And the hit rate's like 50-50. But when you think there's 10 offers coming in, that's better than 1 in 10. Oh, yeah. So you could always come back with a better offer Monday. You also can become the stalking horse, right? So you submit early, and now that listing agent tells every buyer
here's that our is initial potentially offer,
interested.
Right?
We have a great offer. It's at list. It's waived inspection or has limited inspections. If you want to play, you better come in with a really good offer, and can do so with confidence in their voice versus make believe in their voice that that's actually happening.
Mm.
So anyway, we've segued to bidding wars. And we are trying to keep our podcast to about an hour. We're at 35 minutes in, but today's market is not as driven by bidding wars. So we're gonna shorten this topic a little bit and try to get back to
good catch.
What we're really here to talk about, which are pocket listings, the smoke and mirrors of agents that want you to believe that they are just so special, they have access to a plethora of unlisted homes. And it's not that they don't have a few. I mean, we know of a few. I was just mentioned it today to a buyer that this house is not on the market, but we've represented the client several times, and they've told us that, you know, we might be listing it in the spring as soon as the tenancy is over. Okay. And we happen to have somebody looking for that kind of... It just... That does occur, but it's not frequent.
I mean, it's a lot more natural, right? Or organically created.
It likely is not in the best interest of one of these two parties, the buyer or the seller. And the only way I can do that ethically is to disclose that, is to say, look, you have to think about some of the cons of this type of deal.
Mm-hmm.
Unless it's your dream home, like there's a house that listed this week and was under contract within 2 days on Highland in downtown Boulder. It's a very high-end property. It was listed at $10 million. And it was under contract almost immediately. The brokerage community was notified. So if you look at this address, and you know, we have to be cautious, actually. I'm not going to give you the address. And the reason is that real estate agents are not supposed to dish about active deals that are not your own. So I don't know the backstory, but what I do know about this is that the real estate community had basically 48 hours. 48 hours, the agents were notified, there was a broker open, and then boom, it was under contract. So there was enough time, if you had your listing alert set up, and you had a good relationship with a local buyer's agent, for your agent to get into that house, video it, tell you what they thought, maybe have you fly in even, if you had the resources to hop on a very fast flight. But even if you didn't have the resources, we sell a house every year at House Einstein at my brokerage that the client hasn't even seen, because we use high-end videography. You're part of that team, Hamish. We've got gimbaled cameras, fast lenses.
It's same day, too, for the most part.
Most of the time, same day, 4K video, and we're going through the house. It's like an hour-long video where we're looking at what's right and what's wrong with the house. In order to give those clients an opportunity to get in and see this listing that is not going to be around very long. So that particular house is a trophy property. It's an heirloom property. It's something that stays in families for generations, and it's been that way since construction. It's in the most prestigious historic neighborhood in Boulder. The first owner was likely very affluent. It's an estate quality property, and if you've been looking in Mapleton Hill for that type of thing for a long time, it's sort of shocking that you could be looking for a decade and what you were looking for disappears in 48 hours, right? Like, that's nuts. But that's also real estate, and opportunities that are truly super attractive are usually only available for 4 or 5 days, 6 days. Although sometimes you have to wait for the right buyer. That scenario also exists. The property is very unique. It doesn't appeal to the mass market, and so you have to sit and wait, but you know the value of it. It's not about the price. It's about waiting for the right buyer to appear and increase the size of the funnel by marketing it as much as possible so that people outside the immediate market see it. And that's the case of our Sugarloaf listing, actually. We're going to do a high-end video plus our usual photography, and we're going to boost it across Denver as well as Boulder because it's such a unique property. It's so architecturally significant and attractive. It really deserves a much bigger funnel than just sticking it on the MLS like most agents do. Yep. All right, I think we've talked. All right, so let's go through what we've talked about as a quick review, right? We talked about the definition of pocket listings. We've talked about the pros of pocket listings. We've talked about some of the cons of pocket listings. I've talked about how it's triple regulated, which really begs the question, you know, if an agent is pitching you on their pocket listing, one of the things you may want to ask them is, how does this fit in with clear cooperation guidelines? and see if they squirm.
Yeah, they would.
Right? Or if they don't know the answer to the question. And if they don't know the answer to the question, there's a good chance they're violating clear cooperation, which it's their license at risk, I suppose. But at the end of the day, if they're going to behave unethically with respect to the ground rules, you have to also ask, are they telling you all of what's good and what's bad with this potential deal? Or are they just trying to line their own pockets with a double-ended commission? I would be so wary if I was in a different market, not licensed, right? I didn't know any of these things, and I've got the sly agent. You know, good salespeople can be very convincing. They can be, have been doing this for decades. You want to believe. You love the house. It's only later you find out that things weren't disclosed, that you overpaid. Or that the house was purchased by the cousin of the buyer's agent who was supposed to be neutral and undersold the house for you because you're from out of town and you just wanted to get rid of it. And you told this person all these things, and they used that information against you to again, benefit their family or themselves. So many problems with pocket listings. And that's why the regulators, that's why the MLS, that's why the National Association created these rules, because of how problematic and conflicted they are. Pocket deals.
Yeah.
Pocket.
Ridiculous pocket gray area there.
Well, a gray area where there was so much abuse that it had to be triple regulated in Colorado. Right?
Yeah.
Like, we're not just talking about a speed limit set by the highway authority. We're talking about everyone grouped up and said, okay, we're going to have three different speed limit signs.
You really got to do something
to remind
about this
you.
One. Yeah.
Yeah. And likely a source. I mean, I don't go through the complaints at DORA, but I suspect you would see a lot of complaints related to this prior to them creating these rules. And as an employing broker, as the one that is supposed to be supervising agents in my company, we talk about this issue because I don't want them to get in hot water with conflicts of interest and clear cooperation with other agencies. And if they do get into trouble, it's likely going to be through DORA itself, the Division of Regulatory Agencies in Colorado, or a complaint in the Ethics Committee at the National Association. Either case, your life is now going to be pretty miserable as they go and investigate this. And that's, and the fines alone are going to be painful, the potential censure or removal of your license, but you also have a potential big check you could be writing if the person who's aggrieved hires an attorney, which in these high-end deals in Colorado,
almost guaranteed.
If you really have behaved in an unethical way and benefited one of these two parties, and you have not done a great job of documenting. I mean, there's a reason why if we're put in this position, and I have done them where the tenant wanted to buy the property, right? And we're getting ready to list. The tenant wants to buy it. We gave them a discounted commission way below what we would have made if we listed it officially. And that deal required three times the work of a normal deal because the whole way through the deal, the tenant buyer thought that we were ripping them off, that something was fishy. And meanwhile, they were getting an incredible deal, but I haven't done one of those in about a decade because of how much additional work it required, and the fact the tenant didn't trust me created so many problems in the deal. I don't do those anymore.
It's almost better to get one of our team members on as a representative for the buyer, right? At that point,
yeah, these are your options. You can pay the 2.8 to the buy side. I'm not going to do it for a paperwork fee. If you want a paperwork fee that you have the buyer already and you just want the paperwork handled, you probably are better off with an attorney. That's what I would push someone to, because that's honestly not worth the – to do it at a discount is not worth the liability. It's just we have other things to do than get involved in a deal that has so much risk and so little return, where somebody feels like they weren't treated fairly because they didn't have their own representation.
Yeah.
All right, so that's what we talked about. We talked about how to complain. So I'll wrap this up. We are now at... Where are we? Where's the clock, Hamish? 45 minutes. I think we're going to save under an hour. We're going to be under an hour this time. So if you are looking for me, Osman@HouseEinstein.com is my email address. You can also find me at houseeinstein.com. I'm the employing broker of our little brokerage here in Boulder. Our footprint is Boulder, it's Denver. So basically across the Front Range, up to about Fort Collins. We do deals in Loveland and in Berthoud. I have gone as far as south as Castle Rock and Colorado Springs for clients that were pre-existing clients. They were not first-time clients with me. They said, Osmond, please represent me in Colorado Springs. I did that and would do that again for current clients that I've worked with before. But we have an amazing team that's covering a large part of our market, and also I was now moving into the mountains in Breckenridge in Grand County. So check us out at houseeinstein.com if you are looking for an agent to represent you on the buy side or the sell side. If you're looking to sell your home or you're looking to buy a home here in Colorado.
Make a smarter real estate decision.
That's our mission. It's what we do. And hopefully those that are listening to this podcast enjoy it. I love the feedback we're getting on YouTube. Thank you so much for the comments. We need to do a better job of responding to them, but we will get to them eventually. It's just we focus on our buyers and sellers first before we're trolling to respond to comments on YouTube. But I do appreciate them, and I do read them.
Yeah. Well, cool.
All right. So we'll catch you next time.
Thank you, everyone.
Thanks so much. Take care.
Take care.
Bye.